Hey everybody, this is Connor, your podcast producer. Welcome back to the Yellowbird Connect podcast. Kyle is in the studio today chatting with Jason Hartman. Jason has done just about everything there is to do in this space. He is an educator, a mentor, an author. He is the host of the Creating Wealth Show podcast, and you can also find him at jasonhartman.com. He's got a bunch of stuff to share with you. Hope you enjoy the conversation and have a great week.
The main reason we started Connect is to give everyone the opportunity to do what I did.
We wanted to be able to offer the real estate community, especially locally, something new, something that was fresh.
And if we can help a couple people change their lives through this education.
Just one person or two people coming up to me saying, man, that was awesome. Like what you put on was great.
Then it'd be a huge win for everyone.
If you've gotten any value at all from this Yellowbird podcast, make sure to like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Yellowbird Podcast. We're here with Jason Hartman today from South Florida. I actually met Jason down in IMN Single Family REIT Conference back, I would say, December of last year, so it would have been 18, and had a good lunch with him, good conversation. I heard his name prior before and couldn't really connect the dots, and still, you know, had a 30-minute probably lunch with him, and now I get a chance to sit down and have a little bit more one-on-one and learn more about what he does. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Well, hey, thanks for having me, and it's good to see you again. That was a good conversation we had at lunch. I really could tell you knew what you were talking about, both from a real estate industry perspective, but also from the perspective of the way venture capital works and the way, you know, really it distorts markets. It distorts businesses. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's kind of interesting how that happens. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Jason, we have kind of a local RIA here that we run. Probably 250 or so people sign up. It's probably the majority of who listens to this. So it's a lot of local Jacksonville guys, anywhere from, you know, I'm looking to buy my first rental or first flip to the guys that own a couple hundred homes. So we got a really wide kind of audience. But why don't you give us your little 30-second background on where you started, how you got in the business, and what you guys do today.
Okay, well, super quick. I grew up poor in Los Angeles, didn't like being poor. When I was 18, I went to my first real estate seminar. And when I was 19, my first year of college, I got my real estate license just to kind of learn the basics, learn the business. And about 6 months into my career with Century 21, I bought my first rental property in Huntington Beach, California, and I've been investing ever since. And then I bought a traditional real estate company and sold it about 8 years later to Coldwell Banker. And I thought, what am I going to do with my life? And I started, that deal was a very long, complicated deal. It took about a year to negotiate. And as I was negotiating that deal, I started talking to financial advisors about what to do with my money. I knew I'd have this big check coming in, didn't know, you know, what to do. Was I going to retire? What am I going to do about a career? I don't know. And it just dawned on me one day. I thought, what am I doing talking to these Wall Street people? I'm a real estate investor. You know, I got into this business because I love real estate, and I've been investing, made a bunch of money all these years. And I thought, wouldn't it be easy, though, if there was a way to invest in real estate the way Wall Street makes it easy to invest with them? Sure. And I always thought, you know, they've really got like a mediocre product. I mean, I don't think the stock market is very legit. I think it's scammy in a lot of ways. And they've got a great sales force, though. They make it really easy. You know, you can just go in and write them a check, right? And why can't real estate be that easy? And it's not that easy, even now, but it's getting easier.
Definitely.
There's a lot of great technology that makes it easier. And I mean, look at the scale you guys operate at. It's amazing. You know, what you're doing, you're doing a large volume of deals. You've got a big portfolio you're keeping, and that's, you know, largely enabled by technology, right?
Big time.
Would have been much
like
harder
said,
to do that 20 years ago.
For sure. And like you said, the Wall Street versus the, you know, we've had the same thing. I go to a lot of conferences and attend and kind of listen to a lot of people pitch the different models. And I always comes back to just like, why would I do something else when, you know, we've got it figured out here locally. We know exactly what we're doing here. And yeah, sure, you can look at a lot of these big picture things, but then you start getting the fluff of Wall Street, you get the fluff of institutional capital,
right,
and your whole decision making completely changes.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it really does. I agree.
So what else? So today, so kind of flash forward, what are you working on today? What's your make for business?
Well, of course, I've got the business where we run a real estate referral network and we help people buy properties nationwide, build their portfolios. I've been in some iteration of that business for the last 15 years, and it's been a great ride. For my own portfolio, I just sold an apartment complex that I owned with one of our clients. And I got to tell you a funny story about that. I'm doing the 1031 exchange now. Okay. And the funny story is, you know, we've all heard that it's bad to procrastinate. And, you know, procrastinators lose, you know, if you don't make up your mind, you're going to lose out on opportunities. Occasionally.
Not always. Occasionally. We say with our rental portfolio, we say it all the time. We still don't have an end direction with it. We haven't sold it. We haven't done a big, you know, cash out refinance, anything like that. But every month we've waited, it's actually been better. And we always look back saying, good thing we didn't sell it. Good thing we didn't do, you know, make any decisions because interest rates continue to come down. Yeah, so I know what you mean.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of it. This story is slightly different than that, but I get what you're saying. You know, it's the buy and hold mentality, which I love and I agree with. I have not sold a property outright for a long, long time. I always do 1031 exchange. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with my single family home portfolio, I usually do the 2-for-1 model, right? Yeah. Or the 1-for-2, sorry, yeah. That way around, where, you know, I'll sell one that's appreciated a bit and I'll buy two more and I'll improve my cash flow by about 25%. And that's a great deal. I've done that one many times. But on this one, my partner sent me the contract to sign for the sale of the apartment complex. And it was, I think it was $3,550,000 was that deal. And I called up the agent and, you know, she was rambling on about what a great buyer it is, what a great deal it is. And, you know, honestly, I was just kind of busy and I put it off and I didn't sign it. And then another offer came in. And it was much
beautiful.
Better. And then we thought, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so hasty about selling this. I honestly didn't want to sell it at all. He did. And I was just kind of going with the flow, being an easy partner. But, you know, I thought, fine, I'll sell it. And it turns out we sold it for $5 million.
Wow. So that's crazy. So normally it doesn't work like that.
No, not always.
No, I get it. I get it.
I admit it. It doesn't always. But the power of procrastination just made us an extra $1.4 million.
Sure. So. Sure. I know. We battle that one all the time. I'm a big believer in first offer is your best offer. Yeah. And so often, you know, I'll get a full price offer day one and I'll have people, hey, let's hold it out. We've got 16 more showings this weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm the guy that will make me a full price offer. I'm going to take it. And then, you know, but the times that I give it the weekend, half the times I'll make, you know, 5-10% more by letting it float out there. But at the same time, it's like, sometimes you'll miss that call and you'll say no to that first offer, even though it's a good one, it's strong. And then it'll just go silent.
Then it's should have, could have, would have.
You're like, man, I should have, would have, could have.
I know.
But I get it.
Yeah. Awesome. And, you know, maybe the lesson for your listeners, of course, I mean, it's probably an obvious lesson, but we'll just point it out anyway, just in case, is, you know, if you are in a declining market, you want to lead the market down. Definitely. Right? You want to make the decision quickly before it gets cheaper later. If you're in an increasing market, you know, you can afford the power of procrastination, right?
I mean, great leading question. What do you think the market is, and, you know, coming in the second half of 2019, where do you see it going?
I think we really right now are in a pretty weird place. I think we have the tale of two markets. And when I say that, I mean two major segments of the real estate market. We divide markets all around the world into three types of markets, linear, cyclical, and hybrid. And so the cyclical markets, I'll start with those. Those are the markets we all hear about on the news, the high-flying markets, you know, the West Coast of the U.S., the expensive northeastern markets, South Florida, where I live. You know, these are expensive places to live, high land values. They don't make sense to invest in them. Sure. If you put your money in these markets, you're really not investing. You're speculating. You know, you're betting on the greater fool theory. No matter what I pay, some greater fool will come along and pay more. And, you know, listen, don't get me wrong. You can win doing that if you time it right, but it's pretty hard to time it right consistently. And then the linear markets are the opposite of that. There are places like Jacksonville. There are places like Memphis, Indianapolis, Little Rock. These are markets we love. We've been doing business in them for many, many years. Most of planet Earth is linear. That's the vast majority of the world. Yet the cyclical markets, there's not many of them, but you hear about them on the news all the time because they have a bigger story to tell. They're like a roller coaster. You know, they have glorious highs, really ugly lows. They're newsworthy. Sure. So around the world, cyclical markets would include places like Hong Kong, Dubai, Paris, London, et cetera, right? All these flagship sort of cities in the U.S. They include, you know, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, right? And then there's hybrid markets just in between the two. So that's pretty easy to explain. So I think right now, and you're probably seeing this too, in a linear market like Jacksonville, you know, the market is booming. The supply is constrained. Inventory is tight. Bidding wars for properties for this basic bread and butter housing, right? Yep. That is super, super healthy. Like, really, it's a seller's market, no question. But in the cyclical markets, that has been overvalued for years, and it's finally softening, and it's long overdue for softening. You know, I was saying that back in 2013 and 14, that all those markets are too expensive. But, hey, you know, they went for a few more years, and now they're finally adjusting. So so those markets, that's the tale of two markets, really. Those are soft markets. Definitely. And the interesting thing is, you know, for your listeners, is when you look at the most widely cited index for real estate prices, it would be none other than, we all know it, the Case-Shiller Index, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one most media outlets use. And the main Case-Shiller Index only profiles 20 markets. And of those 20 markets, 75% of them are cyclical. Only 25% are linear or hybrid, right? So you get a very false, distorted picture of what's going on out there if you're just listening to the news. This is why, you know, it's much more nuanced than that. There's about 400 market areas in the United States. It's a huge country. And the vast 75% of these markets are probably linear. Yet the index shows all the cyclical markets. So,
and the majority of the population doesn't think like that at all. They think of one. They think it's one way. It's the same reason I fight a lot of the, you know, hedge fund models, the open door models, the iBuyer models. Is, you know, even if you figure it out in one market, it's completely different in every market, and it's its own. It's its own economy. It's its own ecosystem. It's its own way to operate. You know, the way you buy houses in one market is different than another market, and how you do construction in one market is different than another market. And it truly is, you know, individual markets, even though people like to tend to group it together as the housing market, or should I invest in real estate in general? And I agree, it's very localized.
Absolutely. The quote for the day is, all real estate is local. All real estate is local, right?
Sure. Yeah. And I think as an operator, you understand that as Wall Street, they don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
You know, as a lot of it's so, and that's always been, you know, one thing I've always fought back on.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
And the media, you know, you can't get on CNBC or any news program, and TV is the idiot's medium, as we all know, right? Yep. And you can't explain that in a soundbite. You know, it's just, it's what is the housing market doing?
True.
Oh, it's either up or it's down. You know, that's just too broad. It's not enough.
It really is. So what do you see? So you've obviously deal all over the country. I mean, what do you see as your top, like, one, two, three markets that you guys are in? Where do you see the most growth?
Well, you know, we've been in Indianapolis the longest. I mean, I've been doing business in Indianapolis for, 12 years now, maybe. And that's still good. I mean, prices have gone up in all these markets, no question, but not extremely. I mean, the rents keep pace fairly well with the prices. And just so you know, when you look at rents versus prices, prices always rise faster than rents, almost always, at least over a long period of time. Yep. And the rents are always kind of playing catch up. But in the linear markets, they're not that far out of sync. In the cyclical markets, they get really out of whack. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, Indianapolis is solid still. Memphis is still solid. We like Jacksonville quite a bit where you are. That's great. You know, the Texas markets, a lot of them have gotten a little bit expensive. Mm-hmm. Atlanta, we like a lot, but that's it's a little expensive now. And you know, that's two good examples when we talk about that middle category of markets, which is the hybrid markets. Atlanta and Dallas have really always been considered linear markets until this last cycle. I would call both of them hybrid now. Now, I don't think they're extremely hybrid. The more extremely hybrid markets are places like Austin and Denver.
Sure.
Okay. But Atlanta and Dallas are
There's massive institutional money that poured in there. Those two, if you name any two markets where everybody went, I mean, those two got hit hard by everybody.
And Phoenix, by the way, I didn't mention Phoenix. Sure. That's in the category with Denver and Austin too.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep. Well, what else are you seeing out there? I mean, where are you seeing a lot of optimism from? I know you deal with people all over the country. A lot of your buyers, I'm guessing, aren't always localized to the market they're investing in.
Oh, they're almost never localized. Yeah, and very few of them.
So what are you seeing from them? Is there a big increase in supply? Or, I mean, obviously, you're probably struggling with supply, I'm guessing. It's always trying to find the inventory, find quality, find the right numbers that fit an investor profile. But on the flip side, on your buyer side, is there a lot of, is there plenty of people still looking to enter the space?
Yes, there are, as long as they're well-educated people, there's still a much greater population of uninformed people who listen to that dumb soundbite they heard on the news or that little, two sentences they saw in the Wall Street Journal that don't explain things well. But the people that get it. They know that the opportunity is great. I mean, interest rates are phenomenal. Yeah. They even got a little better.
They're stupid cheap.
Oh, they're stupid cheap. The money is free. Yeah.
It's free.
It's, one of the things I talk about a lot is something I call inflation-induced debt destruction. And that is the concept that you're essentially getting paid to borrow the money. Like right now and for several years, we have been in and out of a market where the cost of borrowing is lower or at par with real inflation.
There's no doubt.
Unbelievable. We're in a negative interest rate environment. And by the time you rent the property out, because we don't even pay our own debts. I mean, the tenants pay the debt for us. Yep. And they usually give us a little extra every month, too. Positive cash flow. It's just a
And the fact you can lock it in for 30 years at those rates, it's just silly.
Yeah, three decades.
It really is absolutely silly.
And that's why the United States has a very special housing market. Sure. That's one of the many reasons. But we have these government subsidized mortgages, through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And man, 3 decades. Think about it. Someone's listening to your show today and they go out and they buy one of your properties or one of my properties from us, right? And they won't make the last payment on that mortgage if they don't refi until 2049.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable what's even out there.
I mean, think of how much the world will change by 2049.
It's crazy. I mean, that's always the hedge too. It's a hedge against, I mean, even if you've got good debt and you can get a quality house and keep it long time, you're going to make money on it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's almost no room for failure as long as you stay consistent, manage them correctly, make sure they're safe and everything for a tenant. You know, you're going to come out ahead in that game. Yeah. Even if, regardless of markets, up and down, swings, things like that, you're going to come out ahead.
No question. So. You got to be willing to do the drudgery, though. Landlording is not glamorous by any means. Yeah. It's a very rote job. We have clients that, they buy a dozen houses from us or 20 or 50 or whatever, right? And, it's just like a month after month, you just got to do the thing. And it's pretty boring, honestly. Yeah. But, it's just so consistent. And
you just got to manage it. I mean, a lot of people think it's always easy and it's not, but if you can either manage it yourself or have a really good third party manager that can stay consistent with it, understand what expectations are met and make sure you provide quality housing, then it is a boring job. And when it's boring, it's going well.
Yeah.
So that's what you really want it to be boring. You don't want a lot of excitement. You don't want a turnover or anything crazy happening. You just want people paying rent on time and keeping houses maintained.
Good point.
So it is very simple. What about, are you in the iBuyer space at all? Are they down by you? Do you see them at all? Do you compete with them?
No,
I want to kind of get your opinion on that.
I think it's interesting. I think these iBuyer companies, and it harkens back to that conversation we had in Scottsdale, Arizona last year. But, I think there are some perverse incentives going on in the marketplace, just as they went on with the dot-com bubble back in 1999, 2000. Where these companies are like these overfunded tech companies that, yes, their business plans today are more sensible than they were 18, 20 years ago, but not that much more. They can overpay for properties and do things that don't make sense just because they have such a massive amount of funding. And I'm not saying that they're doing this on any kind of wholesale basis. I don't think it's crazy, but I do think that we have yet to see someone really commoditize real estate.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting there, you know, like if it was a, you know, if you're looking at the needle on a speedometer, right? The needle is definitely moving in that direction, but it's not a stock. It's not an airline ticket. It's not a concert ticket. It's not a commodity yet.
Yep.
You know,
it's still an individual transaction.
Yeah.
It's still,
yeah.
It's still an emotional decision for most, you know, most sales.
Right. It's pretty imperfect still,
sure.
You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what, you know, that's what I always fight that model is. It is still such an imperfect business, and you can try to scale it, make it perfect, but it's just not. It's just not. It's such an imperfect business. So,
yeah.
Do you deal with a lot of international people or a lot, many of your buyers international?
Yes, yes. My podcast has listeners in, we just looked again. We used to say we had listeners in 165 countries. Now we have listeners in 186 countries.
Wow.
So I was very excited to see that.
Have you seen anything in the last year or so? Is that increasing, decreasing the number of people that want to invest in the States?
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with the currency prices, right?
Sure.
And so when the dollar is strong, it's not as good for them because our real estate gets more expensive to them. But still, people internationally realize that the U.S. has a very special real estate market. And we mentioned earlier because of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac government subsidies, of course, but also because our data, you know, and I think people just underestimate this. Our data here is so much more transparent than it is around the world. I've been to 83 countries now, and some of them many times, and I was born in Europe. And, you know, I tell you, the data is just not good. I look at properties. I go with brokers in these other countries I visit. I always make it a point to do that if for no other reason than getting a tax deduction on the trip. You know, it's just the data is just very lumpy and inconsistent. And, you know, we have the MLS. We have very transparent data. You know, they have their versions of Zillow and things like that in a lot of cases, but it's just not like it is in the U.S. And if you want to make good decisions, it really helps to have good data.
You got
right?
to.
And yeah, and so that's a huge advantage of the U.S. We also have a much better rule of law. Now, certainly there's no shortage of people in the U.S. that'll rip you off with no conscience whatsoever. That's very depressing. But by and large, you know, we have rule of law here, and you know, most people stick somewhere within the boundaries.
No, definitely. Yeah, and you're 100% right about the data.
Yeah.
It is, especially entering, you know, coming from a different market. We used to deal with a lot of people from Australia and a big group from China that we used to sell a bunch of properties to. And that was one of the main things they would always say is, you know, within Jacksonville, you could look at it from afar and actually know what you're buying, know what values are, be able to track, are they going up, down, are rents going up and down?
Absolutely.
And they said that where they were, they didn't have that ability just wasn't there. It was too spread out. It was even like we say, our markets, you know, nationally, or we're talking about locally, I mean, theirs were so specific because you really had to know what you're buying, especially this guy we used to deal with in Australia. It was so just different there. And the rules were so different mm-hmm. than here's. They could just get a much broader, bigger picture on it.
Couldn't agree more. And not just that, but, you know, a lot of people investing in the U.S. are really afraid of their own governments.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we complain about our government all the time in the U.S., which is great because that's our right. You know, compared to what is the question? I mean, you know, my girlfriend and I went to China about 2.5 months ago, and it was my first trip to mainland China. And, you know, you see the unbelievable amounts of wealth being created there, but guess where it's coming?
Yeah.
A lot of that money flows over here. You know,
sure.
It's, well, no, they leave, they take it out. They want to get it out of China because they don't trust their government and, you know, rightfully so. And so the U.S. has always been known as the Brinks truck of the world, right?
Definitely.
Because the money's been pretty safe here. So,
yep.
Yeah.
No, definitely. 100% agree. What else you got? Anything else you want to talk about? Anything you want to know about me?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to know your method for buying properties. I mean, you really have got that down to an awesome assembly line, and you know, you're just killing it. I mean, how many per month are you buying?
So we're on average, we're right around 30 a month.
So one a day.
So we're buying. I would say, and people ask me this all the time. I would say we're probably 25% to 30% foreclosure auctions. So I have four counties here. We daily do. We do Duval, Nassau, Clay, St. John's County. So we're there pretty heavily. We're there every single day. We're consistent.
Give us insight into the auctions nowadays. I mean, is the institutional money bidding against you at those auctions?
Yeah, pretty heavily. Okay. So pretty heavily. But, you know, we have – the good thing about Jacksonville is we're so diverse. You've got $10,000 low-end houses, million-dollar houses, and everything in between.
Right.
So you've got the hedge funds are – you know, there's 20% or so of the marketplace that they're strong in. So we try not to – we don't compete with most of them. And we kind of – we still look at every one of those houses. The good thing about, I would say, my model is we're super consistent. So every single day we show up ready to bid. Even the hedge fund models, a lot of the other people, they're constantly coming and going. We show up every single day with our numbers ready to go. But it goes through cycles. I mean, the auction is one of those things, again, you just got to be ready for it, because the day that nobody else – you're bidding – often you're just bidding against somebody else not being there.
Right.
There's not that many players. You know, if there's 5 or 10 people that play every day, so if you can get 3 or 4 of them, don't get out of bed that morning to bid, you've got a good chance to, you know, to buy stuff. Some days there's 15 people in it and you kind of waste your time showing up.
So foreclosure auctions.
So we're pretty heavy in foreclosure auctions. Do a lot of direct marketing. So probably about 1/3 of our deals come from direct marketing. That's the We Buy Houses, postcards,
the yellow postcards,
letters in the mail, Facebook ads, Google AdWords, all that stuff. And then we've also probably just as big as anything is just our network. So we've been in this market for about 15 years. We have lots of relationships with really wholesalers, other realtors, down to business owners and probate attorneys and everybody in between. So we're just constantly out there looking. We run a localized RIA called Yellowbird Connect. We have about 250 or so people that show up, and it's a good place for us to kind of educate, teach the audience the business. It's also a good place for us to kind of bring in deals, meet new people, kind of be a steward of inventory as it flows through, and see if we can help kind of connect deals and do deals together. So it's sort of worked for us, but that whole you know, acquisition strategy is constantly changing. I mean, if you would have asked me 5 years ago, MLS would have been a big part of that. Today it's probably less than 5%.
I'm actually kind of surprised to hear the foreclosure auctions are working that well for you, though. I mean, hasn't that dried up a lot?
We'll have 1 week where we buy 10 and 1 month where we buy nothing. So it literally just goes through cycles. Sometimes it's really good. I'll say the bank numbers, banks have over time not wanted to take properties back. So it's been a big shift. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you felt like there was deals that banks probably, you know, they thought they were worth more. Today, banks at the foreclosure auctions typically don't want to take properties back. So the numbers that banks are letting properties go for are much fairer today than they've ever been. The problem today is competition. So a lot of times for us is we're just waiting for the competition not to show up.
Yeah. And do you own your own construction company?
We outsource. We have probably 30 guys that work for us, labor guys, daily. They're not on staff, but they're all subcontractors. We've had the same group for at least 7 or 8 years, the same guys. And then we have a lot of subs beyond that. So we do anywhere from 12 to 15 renovations a month, complete, you know, from, you know, complete home flips from small jobs, $10,000 jobs to, you know, $80,000 to $100,000 renovations and kind of everything in between.
Yeah.
And so construction's been tough. I know the state of Florida's got, you know, after Hurricane Irma came through, what, 2 years ago now, I mean, construction prices just literally on that date, everything went up 30-40%.
That much?
Labor costs, every single item. So it's been one of the big pinches for our market is between competitive pricing and construction. It makes it a lot more difficult.
Dive into the construction cost a little bit. Why 30 or 40%? I mean, what specific things do they require?
I think a big part about it is you were just saying earlier, inflation. You know, people's general labor costs. You know, what we used to pay one man to work for a day was, you know, 5 years ago, $150 a day was a good labor rate to get somebody to go work. Today, you just can't find that for any quality. So a lot of it is just general cost of living. I think in general, you know, we went up 30% in the last 3-4 years on just what it costs to, you know, just whether it's housing, whether it's insurance, health insurance, any single item, food costs. You know, you used to go to a restaurant and get a sandwich for $8, and now everything's $12, $15 every time you leave. So
yeah.
I think just generally life is just getting more expensive.
Who says there's no inflation, huh?
Exactly. Well, I think beyond that, I mean, I think the biggest thing within real estate is just affordability. It's going to be our biggest struggle is how do, you know, the general public afford to live places, and the people, you know, like yourself and us and people that can provide quality housing at affordable prices is something that's unique that there's a huge demand for.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, the construction was everyone struggling with that. I mean, that's probably one of the biggest struggles that we have is that cost.
That's the labor side, but the specific codes, you know, what did they require that was so expensive that made your construction costs go up that much?
I mean, it's just everything. I mean, I think the labor side's gone up a lot, but then you look at individual, you know, roofing materials, asphalt, all that stuff. It's just everything's kind of gone up with it.
Yeah.
I used to own an air conditioning company I sold out of about 4 or 5 years ago, but our average cost of equipment for a 3-ton air conditioning unit was $1,400 or so. And today it's almost $1,900, $2,000 for the same equipment. So not including labor, just the cost of materials. So stuff's just gone up across the board. And we've tried to answer every question and try to dive into everything really deep and find cheaper ways to do it. But it's something that's definitely pinching the industry. And yeah. I think everybody's sort of feeling it.
Sure.
One way or the other. And the problem is you can't, you know, just because something costs more doesn't mean you can cut corners and do it for less.
Right, right. Yeah, the consumer won't always participate in your cost increases, will they?
No, they don't. I mean, that's always the struggle. But, you know, it's like anything else. You know, you got to kind of take the market as it is and do what you can with it and look for opportunities. And it's going to, you know, when that gets more expensive, that means somebody else is struggling too. So you just got to figure out how you can be better than the next person.
Right.
And get more effective.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Absolutely. So your experience with the iBuyers, though, that's pretty good, right? I mean, you're selling quite a few properties through them, it sounds like.
So they're an excellent buyer. I would say their systems that they've worked out, I wish we did it ourselves. I wish the transactions were as smooth. You know, the online system, when you go in and you put your address in, you put a little bit of information, 24 hours later, you get an offer, you know, sent to you, and it's all Express really easy to understand, really easy to read. So I think for the retail, you know, seller, it's an amazing kind of, I always say it's sort of the backstop. It's a number that they get. That's a cash offer. That's hard. That's real. And gives them kind of a bottom baseline of here's what I could get for my house, you know, kind of worst case. And then you can only go up and then you can make your decision whether you're going to, you know, renovate the home or list it with an agent or whatever the option is.
Do you negotiate with them at all?
They don't much. So they don't much. You can try, but there's not much opportunity there. So for us, it's, you know, we've sold probably a dozen or so homes through their system. And, for the most part, everything's went really smooth. The question is, can the model sustain?
Well, and did you get a decent price? I mean, apparently you did.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So our question is always, can the model sustain? You know, can they continue to pay that number and make it profitable?
Right.
It's one thing when you're first starting to just try to build market share and just show that you're buying a lot of houses. At the same sense as over time, can it be profitable? And at some point, your investors want their money back.
Right, right. And how much of that overly funded VC money are they using to buy the property versus the economics of the property deal itself?
Sure. You know, and right now it can't be. I know for a fact it's not a profitable model. I mean, Zillow last week came out with their earning report for their second quarter, and I think it said they lost $71 million in their home buying side. Stock took a big hit. And it's one of those things, you know, I think they're all comfortable with a scale model of we got to prove it. We got to go out there and do it. We're going to lose some money, but at some point that has to switch. And I'm just not sure in this business that they're going to figure that one out. Especially globally, you know, they might have a really good operator in one market that kind of can figure it out in one area, but it's still so localized, kind of back to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
It's still how it's operating. It's still so localized and the decision-making is still so localized.
I agree. But, good points.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else you got before we wrap this up?
No, I think we can wrap it up. I mean, you know, income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world is what I always say. And it's still a very good buy. You know, a lot of people say the recession is coming and this is this expansion is long in the tooth, as the saying goes. And I think that's probably true. The recession will come. But, you know, if you're following my 10 commandments of successful investing, you know, you're not going to have a problem. I mean, you're just buying properties that make sense from day one, nothing exciting. When the recession comes, people won't be buying so much. They'll be renting and the renter pool will increase in size. Some people will lose their homes if it gets really bad and they'll look to rent homes from you. So, it's still a fantastic time.
Definitely. How do people get in touch with you?
JasonHartman.com. That's just JasonHartman.com. Or my podcast, The Creating Wealth Show, is on any of the podcast platforms. Just type my name in.
Good deal. All right, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks, Jason, for the conversation. Looking forward to meeting you again someday, face to face. And thanks for everything. If you guys got to reach out to Jason. If you got, if you're interested in buying any rental properties really throughout the country, he's got stuff all over. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks, guys.
Happy investing. We'll be right back.